UK Wine Show, show number 160. Nicola Jenkins from Rat on Recycling. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and it's show number 160 for the 12th of June 2009. Well, after a couple of weeks of great weather, the weather was rubbish this week. But fingers crossed it's starting to improve again. There's some great news. I've had my first berries off a tailberry vine. Well, I think it's a vine. I'm not sure. It certainly crawls everywhere. I think that's enough of Gardens Weekly. In this week's show, we're talking with Nicola Jenkins on recycling. Nicola is from RAP, which stands for Waste and Resource Action Program. We find out about what RAP are and their objectives. And this is show number 3 in our 4-part series looking at recycling wine bottles. As a sneak preview, after we've finished looking at recycling bottles, we're going to explore some of the wine regions of the US. Now, normally I'd do the mystery grape, but Jane thinks we need to mix it up a bit, and this week, as an alternative, we're going to be doing our mystery wine region, which we'll alternate, so 1 week grapes, 1 week wine regions. So this week's mystery wine region, which you need to work out what it is a French wine region producing predominantly white varietal wines. It's a chocolate box region of half-timbered houses and ruined castles and fortresses. Today, some 2,000 mostly family-owned growers bottle and sell their wines, although about 80% of the wines from the region are produced by just 175 companies. That's still quite a bit. Soil types are diverse, but generally the heavier clay and marl give full-bodied and broader flavoured wines, and limestone and sandy soils give more elegance and finesse. While flint, schist, shale and slate give the wines an oily, minerally, bitterly aroma sometimes. This is consistent with a lot of soil types as we discovered about 6 months ago. Of particular importance to the region is the Vosges sandstone, which is used in the area to build churches and cathedrals. Hopefully that's enough to get you going. Some of you will have worked it out by now, but ponder it for a while we have the news with Jane.
Thank you, Chris. EU plans to allow red and white wines to be blended to make rosé wine have been dropped after months of lobbying from wine producers, who argued that it would undermine the value and image of the traditional method of macerating the grapes that's used in France and Italy and across Europe. Blending is legal in Champagne and in the New World, and it was thought the change would allow EU producers to compete more effectively with New World rosé producers.
I'm not sure if I'm in favour of blending whites and reds. Certainly there are some possibilities in new styles of wines, but there's also the possibility of shifting unloved white wines into a trendy category where, frankly, more people are happy with the rosé colour than the quality of the drink. But adding things to wine to change it has been done for a long time. What's the story about these adulterated wines, Jane?
Well, herbs have been detected in a wine jar that dates back to 5100 BC from the tomb of one of ancient Egypt's first rulers, providing concrete evidence of herbal remedies in alcoholic beverages, which had previously only been referred to in medical documents some 1500 years later. The study by the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology carried out tests on one of the 700 jars buried with Scorpion I in his tomb at Abydos. As well as wine, the tests detected tree resin, which was used as a preservative as well as for medicinal purposes, and other chemicals that make up various herbs.
While adding things to wine has been very common practice for most of the existence of wine, but now that we don't add things to wine, things have changed to take things away. What's the story there, Jane?
Well, British consumers will soon be able to purchase a low-alcohol wine 2 years after it was banned by the French government. You may remember the wine. It's from Domaine de la Colombette in the Languedoc under the brand name of Plume, and it's available in red, white and rosé at 9% alcohol. 2 years ago, the wine was to be listed by Tesco, but French wine authorities argued that their reverse osmosis process to take the alcohol out of the wine could not be legally exported as French wine, and the product was recalled. Colombette have successfully challenged the ruling, firstly on the grounds that selling to the UK should not be classified by the EU as an export, because the UK is in fact part of the EU, and secondly, from the 1st of August 2009, reverse osmosis will become a legitimate technique for wine production. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out our website 3050.co.uk for these stories in full.
Cheers, Jane. One of the key things is the 9% alcohol level. Wine in the EU must have at least 8.5% alcohol. except Germany, where they can get away with about 6.5%. But we won't worry about that. If you recall the spinning cone controversy from a year or so ago, they wanted to produce wines that were below 8.5%, which in the EU isn't technically wine, so you get into problems there, using a technique that wasn't permitted. This time, with reverse osmosis now being allowed, which is lucky because it's been used in Bordeaux and lots of regions for a long time, it's another step along the lines of wine being made rather than being grown. But we might get some interesting styles coming out of it, but I think we'll probably end up with some cheaper styles of wine, personally. Now, I learned something interesting the other day about sweet wines and why they're actually quite stable, because you think all that sugar in a wine, wouldn't it just start fermenting again? And it's to do with reverse osmosis or something very similar. So let me explain what reverse osmosis is and then explain why sweet wines are quite stable. In reverse osmosis, it works by having two liquids separated by a porous membrane. On one side, you'll have, say, wine. On the other, water. The pores on the membrane are designed to only let alcohol through or alcohol-sized molecules through. And because of the random movements of molecules over time, the alcohol will move between the two liquids and distribute itself fairly evenly, effectively lowering the concentration of alcohol in the wine and increasing the amount of alcohol in the water. Now, that's how reverse osmosis works. What I learned was that it's the same reason why sweet wines are stable. Yeast in a very sweet wine is mostly made up of water, just like we are, but it's separated by a membrane that lets the water in and out. In very sweet wines, water leaves the yeast and tries to even out the concentration of water between the sugary wine and the yeast. The result is the yeast dehydrates and dies, and the wine won't ferment anymore, becoming very stable. This is the same mechanism that stops food from spoiling by using salt, where the salt pulls the water out of any bacteria and yeasts, effectively dehydrating them. Sorry, I know it's a bit geeky, but I finally worked it out and it's taken me a wee while to work it out and I thought I'd share it with you guys. I've always wondered why sweet wines just don't keep fermenting, because it's not sulfur dioxide that stops it, because yeast is quite insensitive to sulfur dioxide. Sugar may protect wine and salt may protect meat, but salty meat and wine are a tough combination. In this week's Spotlight, we're looking at matching wines to meat. So next up, we have the Spotlight. Many meals are meat-based, and different meats often have different wines that are associated with them. While many people believe that red wines go with red meat and white wines go with white meat, this is only an approximation. The key rule here is to remember that match the weight of the food to the weight of the wine. Let's take poultry. Poultry can be cooked in a variety of ways, but the rule match the weight of the wine with the weight of the food is often correct. Dry white wines are best place to start, especially for a light chicken salad, but for a heavier, heartier roasted or smoked chicken, they can handle a light red wine, and occasionally even a heavier rosé can be an interesting option to the more traditional fuller whites such as oaky Chardonnay and Pinot Gris that you normally have. The next meat is fish. The nature of fish or shellfish and the method of cooking can make a huge difference, but again, the rule is match the weight of the food with the weight of the wine. But also remember, salt is a common flavour in fish, particularly if they've been caught from the sea. Salty food and tannic reds are a bad combination. So, like poultry, whites and light reds with low tannins are okay. However, acidity and salt work really well together, both lifting the dish and reinforcing each other. So for a light, salty fish dish, consider a crisp sparkling wine or champagne. And this is even more true for fried fish, where acidic wines work well with oily and fatty foods. That ends this week's Spotlight, quite a short one. Next week, we're going to be looking at the more heartier red meats and looking at some of the issues associated with proteins and tannins. Don't forget that you can get access to all our Spotlights that we've read out and relevant interviews on our site. We've got pages set up for each Spotlight. You can do it at theukwineshow.co.uk. Do take some time and have a look around at all our different tastings. After all, 3050, the wine tasting company, that's my business, does effectively pay for the show. So do recommend it to your friends or colleagues. We cover all sorts of things about wine tasting, right through from serious one-day wine courses and away weekends, evening courses, and tastings that are loads of fun, from corporate wine tastings, game shows, networking events, even the odd hen party. So whatever you want to know about wine, we've probably got the tasting for you. So if you're thinking about it, recommend us to your friends. But this week, the mystery region isn't Champagne, but it is another French region. So let's give you some more clues. Our French wine region runs through two departments, Haut-Rhin and Bas-Rhin, following the lower contours of the Vosges Mountains. which separate the region from the rest of France. Most of the best are in the south, southeast and southwest facing slopes in order to take advantage of the maximum sunshine in this long, cool growing area. The more southerly Haut-Rhin tends to be regarded as producing better quality wines. The grapes grown here probably give the region away. Riesling, Gewürztraminer, Pinot Gris, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Noir, Muscat, Chasselas, Silvaner and Auxerrois. With such a large range, even the smallest growers make a wide variety of wines each year and of course bottle them in their traditional flute. Any ideas? I'll give you the answer after the interview with Nicola Jenkins from RAP. Let's find out about RAP. Hi, I'm here with Nicola Jenkins from RAP. How are you, Nicola?
I'm very well, thank you.
We're going to be talking a wee bit today about RAP and what you are, what you're trying to achieve. But do you want to just give us an overview first about yourself, actually? I detect a South African accent.
Yes, I am South African and very proudly so, even though I live here. And I actually come from Cape Town, so I'd like to think I'm vaguely knowledgeable about wine.
Excellent.
Yeah.
What's RAP?
RAP's interesting. It's not a sandwich, as some might think, but RAP is actually the Waste and Resources Action Program. We've been around since about 2000, which is really interesting. And I've been with the company for 4 years, and it's really grown. There are about 200 of us. Its history was very much started in dealing with recycling and ensuring that there was a good economic basis for recycling in the country. And I suppose that gives us our name, which is the Waste and Resources Action Program. And we've had to update ourselves a bit, so we look at minimization as well as recycling. And our remit has really expanded. So I work in the retail team and we work very much with the retail supply chain. And that's where very much a lot of our wine work is instigated, as well as in our manufacturing team. Some of you might be very familiar with our public facing program called Recycle Now.
Nope.
So what happens to a bottle and you might be drinking out of the same tin can you recycled 5 days ago, all those lovely TV adverts. Another area where RAP are becoming a lot more prolific is in food waste. Love food, hate waste. Some of you might have seen our campaigns on that. And some of the composting bins you probably would have had at home are all RAP-type initiatives. So a very big, wide spectrum of work. So that is very much where our focus is at the moment.
Okay. Would you class yourself as a government quango or a government department?
That's a very interesting question. We are actually funded by the devolved administration, so Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, as well as DEFRA, and some other smaller organisations, so it is publicly funded money. However, we are an independent company, so we do have autonomy to a degree, particularly in the types of programs and the targets that we set. However, because we are funded by the government, we do need to ensure that all our money is well spent and that we actually publicly notify the general public about what we spend the money on, and hopefully it is a good spend.
Obviously, so if you're government funded, where do your directives come from? Is it, you know, Gordon Brown?
Yeah.
Or is it coming in from Europe? Where are the instructions about targets, etc., coming from? And what are those targets?
They really do vary, but I suppose the biggest player is the EU. In particular, one of the directives called the EU Landfill Directive target. And that target is a very serious target. Basically, it's about reducing the amount of waste going to landfill. And if the UK doesn't hit that target, and we generally don't, we get fined very heavily. And I suppose ultimately that has implications on the tax that we pay. So that's why a lot of the initiatives around increasing recycling, getting us to recycle more, reducing packaging, that's an area that RAP work in order to help the government achieve meeting the EU Landfill Directive target. So I'd say that's one of our major targets. Mm-hmm. There's also the new government bill on CO2 reduction, reducing CO2 levels by 80% by 2050. And that is a huge target.
When governments do targets like 30, 40, 50 years in the future, Everybody knows they're not going to hit it.
Not necessarily. It is achievable. There are achievable targets.
Yeah, but they're so far in the future so that no one can be blamed
Certainly.
For not hitting them.
But what one does, and this is where organisations like RAP are very important, or we feel we have a central role, is that we are there on the ground to assist in achieving those targets. So our business plan is quite often on a 3-year cycle, and within that 3-year cycle, we have to hit certain targets that fulfil ultimately the government's targets.
Okay. I'm very dubious about politicians making grandiose schemes 50 years in the future.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And it's a very serious target. So the question is out there, but we'll do our damnedest.
Okay. You mentioned the landfill target.
Yeah.
What is that target about? You know, what does it actually say?
Ultimately, the landfill directive target is about sending less to landfill.
Mm-hmm. What's the problem with sending stuff to landfill?
Well, the main problem sending things to landfill is space. I suppose that's what most people are familiar with, mm-hmm. particularly in a country which is an island like the UK. We don't have a lot of space. So I think that's the one thing that most people are familiar with. When it gets a little bit more scientific, when landfill waste starts to degrade, it can release a variety of chemicals and gases, in particular methane.
Yep.
And people are very familiar, particularly New Zealanders, and cows and methane and lambs and methane. And if we can reduce product going to landfill, we're reducing a lot of those. But that's at the end. I think what's really important to remember, and a lot of people don't think about this, is if we're actually reducing what's going to landfill, we're reducing ultimately what we're taking out of the earth. So things that actually make glass, things that actually make plastic, we're actually going to be reducing that impact as well.
Okay. What is the target for glass in the UK?
I'm not particularly aware of any targets for the glass industry as per se, but I am very aware of RAP-specific targets on glass reduction. So we estimate, carrying out analyses on waste that arises in the household waste stream, from the hospitality sector, etc., that we can at least reduce what's going out there by 10% at minimum. Mm-hmm. In terms of wine bottles per se, we've ourselves set a target of 30,000 tons of glass weight reduction by the end of this year.
30,000? How many bottles is that?
That's lots, millions and millions of bottles.
What is
the An average wine bottle weighs, and this is where I'm sad, 488 grams. So that's a lot of tons.
Yeah.
But you know, when you start working with the bigger brands, which is what a lot of our work is about, and retailers, those targets can be achievable. And when you think of, and I'm just referring here to the wine industry, when you consider that wine bottles weigh anywhere from 300 grams to a kg, the question is, why a kg? And the likes of Janssens Robinson, etc., you know, they, and yourselves, you know, are quick to question weights of bottles.
Mm.
And, you know, moving to 300 grams, which is not appropriate for everybody,
no.
You're talking of even more than 10%. So the targets we've set are actually quite realistic in the greater scheme of things.
Let's talk a wee bit about what you're actually doing to minimize the targets, etc. To me, there seems to be a couple of things. Probably bulk importing mm-hmm. of wine seems to be the big one. A lot mm-hmm. of people hear about when they're talking about RAP, etc. Do you want to just give us an overview of what is bulk importing
okay.
and what are you trying to achieve?
Sure. For our project, which has got the name Glass Right Wine and has got some sort of funky Americanized title, Right with an R, is that we're very much focusing on two elements. So there's the packaging element and reducing the weight of that. And then the other is to increase the recycled content of wine bottles manufactured in the UK. And it will not be a surprise to most in the wine industry that the UK produces very little wine. We actually import over 98% of our wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's 1.6 billion litres. We are the world's biggest importer of wine. We're not the biggest drinkers. That's left up to the French. It's significant. We do recognize that we are obviously not the only destination of wine, but the UK is a big market for a lot of the wine world, in particular the New World. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of potential to expand the market in the UK. One thing that's very interesting is why are we focusing on bulk importation and recycled content in the UK? The UK's glass manufacturing sector is a very interesting one. It's one that's very much dominated by producing clear glass. The industry call it flint. And that goes into producing bottles for our spirit sector, of which a lot is actually exported over to the Far East. And I'm sure some of the wine industry consume that in their countries of origin. We also produce a lot of clear containers for the food industry.
Jam jars,
honey jars, pickles, you name it. So that makes up a significant proportion. The other area is we do produce a lot of amber and green. It's known as emerald green. It's quite a brilliant green. You might have seen it on the shelves. And that's very historical because that's to feed a rather large beer industry in the UK. So the likes of Stella Artois, you name it. And the wine industry, so is very new to that. And they've just been, the glass industry have therefore just been adopting, well, can we produce wine bottles in clear or emerald green?
Is the emerald green glass different to the glass that we normally, green glass that we use in wine bottles?
It is. It's a different colour. When we say different, it's still green, so it can take a high recycled content. But the common colours that are produced by glass manufacturers in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and the continent is what's called autumn leaf or dead leaf. And some of you might be familiar with it. It's sort of a greeny, yellow, ambery colour.
Yeah.
And what's quite interesting is when we've carried our trials to try and get that colour, actually, if you put recycled glass, all the mixed colours together, it comes out that sort of colour. So for a company like Rapp, that's a real interest to us. So we're starting to explore those options. But what's really good about green, and it doesn't matter almost whether it's emerald or autumn leaf, is it can take a very high recycled content. So it can take anywhere up to 100%, but on average about 80% recycled content.
Okay, whereas normal flint glass, obviously impurities get in it and discolour.
Yeah, it might not necessarily be impurities, but it's more the demand from the brand owners, particularly those in the spirits industry, who want what's called medicinal flint, sparkly, almost magnifying glass colour flint. And the chances are that's probably got minimal, if any, recycled content. However, what's really interesting is if you look at a lot of Italian wine bottles that are clear, they've got a slight green tint to them. Coca-Cola is another good example, and Bacardi.
Yep.
They've all got a slight green tint to them. And so we know consumers are actually, particularly in the alcoholics sector, consumers are actually quite happy to consume wine and spirits from bottles that have got a slight green tint. And some brands see that as an advantage. So that's another area for Rapp.
The advantage of having slight green tint? Is it more recycled content?
It does. It's an indicator that there might be a little bit more recycled content in that bottle. So Rapp, if I can jump ahead a little bit, is we're really keen on, if you are in the wine industry and you would like to bottle in clear or flint, is to really think about increasing the recycled content in your clear bottles, because it can be very effective.
How much can you get up to in clear glass?
About 40%. But it really varies on the quality of the recycled glass, and in the industry that's called cullet, coming into the glass furnace.
Sorry, I don't understand that.
So basically, a glass manufacturer gets sand and it gets silica and a whole number of other things to make a bottle. Recycled glass, which you put out in the curbside, is called cullet to the industry.
Cullet,
C-U-L-L-E-T. And that is just added to the big melting pot.
Yep.
And it has a number of benefits, which we can talk about later. But you can add that to increase your recycled content for different colours, yeah.
Okay. Rosé wines have a short shelf life, and they I quite often bottled under clear glass. Yes. Am I right in saying that clear glass from an your point of view is better than green glass because it has more uses, or?
No, not necessarily. What's quite interesting with colour is obviously UV protection of the wine, and that's something RAP have looked into as well. Not just from a colour perspective, but if you start to thin bottles, will you be letting in more light? But in terms of, to go back to your question about what we think is best, that's really not for us to say. Ultimately, that's for the brand to decide, because there'll be so many variables that they will take into account. What we can say is that green glass can have a higher recycled content. So if that's really important for your brand from an environmental perspective, then that's something to pursue.
Let's jump in a bit more about bulk importing.
Yes.
We were talking offline a wee bit about your focus in terms of the price point for the wines that you're focused in on. And you're saying that about £5 and under is where emphasis.
Yes.
And that sort of fits quite nicely with bulk importing.
Definitely.
Because that's the price point that bulk importing wine would normally come
yes.
in at.
Yes.
What sort of things have you done to improve bulk importing? And has bulk importing grown in the last couple of years?
Yes. Bulk importing has increased. If I can just reiterate, what is bulk importing? Because when I first came to this project, I just thought bulk importing was just meant mass movement. In the wine industry, it means bringing it in flexi tank instead of bringing it over in bottles.
Yep.
And historically, bulk importation has had a bit of a bad rap. Some things have gone wrong. But I think as a result of that, a lot of particularly the bulk importers, the Hillebrands and so on and so forth, the Habbocknagels and so on, have really spent a lot of time on improving the technology of transporting wine to far-flung places. So we've moved from steel tanks, which is what the wine used to come in, to what now is termed flexi tanks, which is basically a big balloon in a tank, to be crude. And I know a lot of emphasis has gone into improving that technology. And if one is to believe the information that is out there, that has certainly gone a long way to improving the technology maintaining quality over traveling distances.
What sort of countries import bulk? Who are the big bulk importers? What are the commercial advantages?
Yeah, there's certainly some big commercial advantages for countries from the New World, and they tend to also be the major bulk importers.
Australia
is a very good example. Argentina, funnily enough, not only are they new emergents in the wine industry, but they also have really leapt on the bulk importation bandwagon. So Fullpack is an example of a company heavily involved in South America bulk importing wine. In terms of...
What about countries like Italy or France?
Yes, they do bulk import, but what's quite interesting is they tend to be a hub for wine bulk imported into the country. So you've got examples of wines that are coming in from America for some of the big brands such as Gallo, etc., that are actually bulk imported from the States to Italy and get bottled in Italy, and then the... wine is distributed across the continent and into the new emerging markets such as China and India. So it's quite interesting that the UK might not necessarily be the hub for bulk imported wine, but some of the other countries in the continent are.
Okay. We did an interview with Kingsland Wine and Spirits a long time ago.
Yes.
And they're a big bottling firm based up near Manchester,
yes.
Leedsways. And they were doing things like, I think it was a bit of PR, to be honest. They were doing things like using barges to bring the wine in a bit further in, so that rather than sort of double handling it and trucking it, etc. Transporting wine from Italy or wherever to Europe costs a lot of money in CO2 in terms of trucking and travel costs.
Yes.
CO2 is quite expensive driving things around.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be far more environmentally friendly to bottle in the UK rather than bottling in Italy and driving through, because use more CO2 going from Italy to the UK than it is from
probably
Australia to
yes.
the UK.
That's a very good question you ask, and I think where it is becomes even more significant if you look at the cost and the CO2 benefits when you look at a country like Australia, where bulk importation can actually reduce CO2 by anywhere from 35 to 45%. That is huge, and that's because you can get a lot more wine into a flexi tank than bottles into a standard 25,000 foot container.
I heard it was something like half the weight and half the volume was wasted in a case of wine.
Yeah, so something along those lines. Not only that, what's quite interesting is RAP have done a piece of work looking at the real nitty-gritty of these reductions. So if anyone's interested, please visit our website, because you can go into the nitty-gritty and find out what are the calculations behind this. But not only can you equate the CO2 savings to other savings, but one of the biggest ones might be economic savings to the supply chain. So you're actually sending less over. You're doing less trips, and I would think that has significant cost reductions. The interesting thing is those cost savings are up to the brands, the retailers, the transport companies to negotiate amongst themselves. That's not for the likes of RAP to become involved in.
What other pros and cons are there for bulk importing?
I suppose one of the biggest pros, or there are a whole number of pros actually, some of them, and this is what we hear from the retailers such as Tesco, Sainsbury's and Asda, is that when it comes to campaigns such as promotions, etc., etc., they have a lot more lead time. So wine is coming in and they can actually make changes to labels and things like that on site in the UK instead of having to make that decision 2 months ago in the country of origin. Yep. So there are those sorts of benefits. Apparently there's a lot more flexibility when bottling in the country of sale.
Okay, that makes sense. Mm. I think we'll wrap it up there. And Nicola, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that interview with Nicola. RAP helps individual businesses and local authorities reduce waste and recycle more, making better use of resources and helping to tackle climate change. Sounds very nice, doesn't it? By working with large companies, they can make a material difference. Their publicity is helping to reduce the amount of waste glass in the UK waste stream. And next week, we're going to be talking with Nicola in our final interview in the series about what RAP are doing to encourage groups to meet government targets. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with our mystery region? Well, our mystery region is in the northeast of France, just beside the Vosges Mountains, making mainly white grapes. It is, of course, Alsace. And to finish up with, we have a quote, and this week it is attributed to H. Warner Allen, again from the wine list at the Commander's Palace in New Orleans. "The wines one best remembers are not necessarily the finest that one has tasted. And the highest quality may fail to delight so much as some of the more humble beverages drunk in more favourable surroundings." Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.